He carefully checked all his preparations over to see whether he could give away his plans to escape. He decided not. Turl seemed very preoccupied these days, indifferent. Or was that a pose? The thing that was really giving Johnny a problem was how to get his hands on a gun. Before all the mutiny precautions, some of the workers he had seen had worn relatively small, compact handguns at their belts. He had supposed they used them for plinking or shooting game. Turl still wore his, a rather bigger one, but the others seemed to have stopped. Johnny wondered how far he could trust Care. The midget was definitely Turl's creature. But from some of the tales Care had chattered on with, he was distinctly criminal. He told how he had rigged certain games of chance, how he had looted ore boxes as a joke, how he had gotten a female to believe her father needed money and relayed it for her. One day, they were waiting for a machine to be idle so it could be used in practice, and Johnny decided to make a test. He still had the two discs he had gotten in the Great Village. He knew now that one was a silvery coin and the other a gold coin. He took the silver coin out of his pocket and began flipping it. "What's that?" Care wanted to know. Johnny gave it to him, and Care scratched it with a talon. "I dug some of these up once in a wrecked town on the southern continent," said Care. "You must have gotten this locally, though." "Why?" said Johnny, alert that perhaps Care could read English letters. "It's fake," said Care. "An alloy of copper with a nickel-silver plating. A real coin, and I saw some once, is solid silver." He handed it back, losing interest. Johnny took out the yellow coin and started flipping it. Care caught it in the air before it could fall back into Johnny's hand. His interest was sudden and intense. "Hey, where did you get this?" Care dented the edge with a talon tip and looked at it closely. "Why?" said Johnny innocently. "Is it worth something?" A very sly look came into Care's eye. The coin he was holding and trying to be casual about was worth 4,000 credits. Gold, alloyed just enough to be used in coinage without undue wear. Care steadied his hand and looked very, very casual. "Where'd you get this?" "Well," said Johnny, "it came from a very dangerous place." "There are more of them?" Care was quivering a little bit. He was holding in his paw 3 months' pay, all in one little coin. And as an employee, he could legally possess it as a souvenir. On Cyclo, it could buy a wife. He tried to remember how many coins it took for them to cease to be souvenirs and become company property. 10? 13? So long as they were old and obviously mintage, not some fake made by a miner. "The place is so dangerous, one couldn't go there without at least a belt gun." Care looked at him searchingly. "Are you trying to get me to give you a belt gun?"
"Would I do something like that?"
"Yes," said Care. This animal was very, very quick on machines. Quicker, in fact, than Cyclo trainees. Care looked longingly at the gold coin or medallion or whatever it had been. He said nothing. Then he handed it back to Johnny and just sat there, his amber eyes shadowed in the depths of his breathe-gas dome. Johnny took the coin back. "I'm careless with things like this. I can't buy anything, you know. I keep it in a hole just to the right of the cage door as you come in." Care sat there for a while. Then he said, "The next machine is ready." But that night, while Turl was making his rounds of the mine site and was distant from his viewing screen, the gold coin disappeared from the hole where Johnny had put it, and in the morning, when Johnny dug there, covering the action with his body, a small handgun and spare charges were in the hole instead. Johnny had a gun. 4. A remaining hurdle was knowledge. The Chinkos were good teachers, and they could stack real learning onto a disk and get it assimilated like lightning flashes. But basically, they had been working for Cyclos, and trying to teach Cyclos, and they omitted a lot of things that Cyclos either already knew or could not have much interest in. This left gaps. Johnny had picked up inferences that there was uranium in the mountains to the west. Mostly he guessed this because no active mining ever seemed to have been undertaken there by the Cyclos. From the accident he had witnessed, and for other reasons, he suspected uranium was deadly to the Cyclos. But he didn't know for sure, and he didn't know how. He was utterly dismayed, in studying the text on electronic chemistry, to find there were many, many different atomic formations of uranium. Sitting at his fire, grinding away at texts and the instruction machine alternately, Johnny was disturbed by the ground shake that always preceded Turl. It was simply the monster's nightly rounds.
"What are you studying so hard, animal?"
asked Turl, looming over him. Johnny decided to plunge, to take a chance. He looked the many feet up to Turl's mask.
"It's the mountains to the west," said Johnny.
Turl looked at him suspiciously for a little while. "There's not much in here about them," said Johnny. Turl was still suspicious. What had this animal guessed? "I was born and raised there," said Johnny. "There's data on mountains everywhere else on the planet, but hardly any on those right there." He pointed to where faint moonlight shone on the bold snow caps. "The Chinkos took a lot of books out of the library. Man books. Are they here?"
"Oh," snorted Turl in relief. "Man books. Ha."
Turl was rather more pleased than otherwise. This fitted into his own concentrations. He left and came back shortly with a battered table and a disorderly armload of books that avalanched down on it. They were frail books, very ancient, and some broke their backs or came apart with his mishandling.
"I am nothing but an animal attendant," said Turl. "If mauling through this gibberish makes you happy, be happy."
He paused at the cage door after he went out and locked it.
"Just remember one thing, animal. The junk you'll find in those man books didn't have anything in them to defeat Cyclos."
Then he laughed.
"Probably lots of recipes on how to prepare raw rat, though."
He rumbled off to the compound, his laughter fading. Johnny touched the books reverently. And then, with hope, he began to inspect them. They mostly concerned mining. His first find was a text on chemistry. It contained a table of elements that gave the atomic formation of every element man had known. With a sudden puzzlement, he grabbed the cyclo text on electronic chemistry. It too had a table on the atomic formation of elements. He put them side by side in the flickering firelight. They were different. Both tables were apparently based on the periodic law, by which the properties of the chemical elements recur periodically when the elements are arranged in increasing order of their atomic numbers. But there were elements on the man table that did not occur on the cyclo table, and the cyclo table had dozens more elements. The cyclo table also had many more gases listed, and did not seem to specialize in oxygen. Johnny floundered through it, not too adept at getting the abbreviations related to the substances, more used to reading cyclo than English. Yes, the cyclos listed radium and even gave it an atomic number of 88, but they noted it as a rare element. And they had dozens of elements numbered and listed above 88. Nothing made it plainer than the difference in these tables that he was dealing with an alien planet in an alien universe. Some of the metals were compatible, but on the whole, the distribution was different, and even atomic formation seemed at variance. At length, he suspected that both tables were imperfect and incomplete, and, with a spinning head, gave it up. He was a man of action, not a chinko. He turned to his next huge question. Were there uranium mines in the mountains?
At length he found some charts and listings. He had been certain that there must be uranium mines, man mines, in those mountains. But all he found were notations that where they had existed they were mined out. What? No uranium mines? No active ones, anyway. Yet he was dead certain that there must be uranium in those mountains. Otherwise, why would the cyclos avoid them? Maybe they just thought there was. No, there must be uranium in those mountains. Some of his plans began to crumble at the edges, and he fell into something like despair. He began to search in the books, looking for any references at all to uranium. And then he hit, as Kerr would say, pay dirt of a sort. It was a book on mine toxicology, a subject he made out as Poisons in Mines Affecting Miners. And there it was in the index, Uranium, Radiation Poisoning. For the next half hour he struggled through the entry. It seemed that you had better damn well be clothed in lead shielding when you fooled around with radium or uranium or radiation. All sorts of terrible things happened if you weren't. Rashes, hair falling out, burns, blood changes. And then he had it. People bombarded with radiation experienced changes in their genes and chromosomes, and birth defects and sterility resulted. That was what was wrong with his people. That was why children seldom came and why those that did were often imperfect at birth. That was the reason for the lethargy of some of them. And that could also be the red sickness and the crumbling away of his father's bones. It was all there. It described exactly what was happening to his people. Why they did not multiply. There was radiation in the village valley. He went back hurriedly to the mine maps. No, there was not even a worked-out uranium mine anywhere around the village. But radiation was what it was. The symptoms were unmistakable. He knew now why the cyclos stayed away from there. But if there were no mines, where was the radiation coming from? The sun? No, not that. Goats on the higher ridges had no trouble multiplying, and he had never seen a deformed goat. Well, he had an answer of sorts. It was not a clean-cut one. There was radiation, but no mines. It struck him abruptly that man must have had a way of detecting radiation. He seemed to know so much about it. Eventually, he found that, too. It was called a Geiger counter, after somebody named Geiger, who was born and died on dates that Johnny had no trace or inkling of. It seemed that radiation, or ionizing particles, if present, passed through a gas. The radiation generated a current in the gas that made a needle react. Radiation somehow generated a current in certain gases. The schematic diagrams were unintelligible to him until he found a table that gave the abbreviations. He could then translate them across into cyclo, which he did laboriously. He wondered whether he could make a Geiger counter. He decided, given the cyclo electronics shop, that he could. But after he escaped, that wouldn't be available. Despair began to creep in on him. He finally put the books away and in the small hours fell into an exhausted sleep. He had nightmares. Chrissy mauled and smashed to bits. His people wasted and truly extinct. And the world of the cyclos come alive and laughing at him.